This podcast is brought to you by the Lucky Education Consultancy and Placement Firm and Alembic Global. Kazangpo and welcome to Hello from Bhutan. I am Namgeza. We are joined by somebody that some of us have followed, I think, her journey. It's Yishe Salden. She is a geophysicist and a graduate student at University of Texas, El Paso. She happens to be the first Bhutanese to have traveled to the South Pole. And this is also one of the main reasons why I invited her on the podcast, because I would love for her to share the wonderful experiences she may have had, and also maybe not so some of the challenges. The videos and the photos she sent me were really wonderful, so I'm assuming that much of it was quite fantastic. Tell us a little bit. I mean, I mentioned that you traveled to, you're the first Bhutanese to travel to the South Pole. You were there, you told me just now, 3 months. You got back February 2nd. What was that experience like?
It was very, I guess, it's overwhelming at first. But after a while, I realized that I was not the only first people, or like the first timers. There was a lot of first timers that didn't know what was going on as well as me. And there was a lot of, in Antarctica, there was a lot of lingos that I had to get familiar with. There was like a lot of stuff to do with logistics that had like unique names to themselves. I don't know how to explain properly, but there were a lot of lingos. Like,
like an example, like, I don't know if I'll ever reach Antarctica, so educate us, please.
There's like a fuel station where you fuel up your snowmobiles, and they have like a instrument to fill up like a petrol pump. Like they have the press pump, but over there's something called like a hurdy-gurdy, where you just turn and then it, from the tension, it pulls up the fuel, and then from a big tank, and then you have to fill up your snowmobiles. But it's called like a hurdy-gurdy. For some,
how do you spell that?
I think it's U-R-D-Y-G-U-R-D-Y. It's like a musical instrument from United Kingdoms, but it's shaped like a hurdy-gurdy. It sounds like a hurdy-gurdy, apparently, but that instrument is called a hurdy-gurdy. And I was like, okay. Those kind of small things. But like people there that are already experienced, they're like, oh, use the hurdy-gurdy. And I'm like, what? What is that? Those kind of things, like a lot of a cultural adaptations to those lingos kind of things.
But do you know like who coined those words? I mean, was it like the first people who reached Antarctica, or who did that?
I'm not really sure. I mean, the first expeditions, or like all those first expeditions in Antarctica, they were mostly United Kingdom people. Like the first person was the Scot, so so I feel like he kind of, maybe not, I don't know how it came up, but it's just funny things, small things that just doesn't make sense in the real world, but makes sense over there kind of stuff.
So what were your expectations? Like, what did you have, like, you know, did you anticipate certain things about traveling south to the South Pole? Like, you know, were your expectations realistic, or, you know, what was the experience like? Did it match your expectations?
I wouldn't say it matched any of my expectations. It was just very different. Like, the flight, first of all, I flew from El Paso to New Zealand. That was a commercial flight. But from New Zealand, it was a U.S. Air Force flight. So there was no like, oh, here's your flight details. You're going to fly in this kind of like, but it was just like a random, like United States Air Force would choose which flight you would fly in today. Like most, I think many people, they fly in C-17. So these are like big military airplanes used in like maybe like in Afghanistan and those kind of things. Like it was those kind of flights. Like it was just very different flight. I didn't expect that kind of flight, or like I didn't expect what it would look like kind of. And then when I was in the Antarctica, when we landed in Antarctica, I expected it to be very, very cold that day, but it was quite hot. So those pictures of me in Antarctica in front of the plane, I was very hot that day.
Oh really? But you had like a snowsuit on, right?
Yeah, I think it was just mandatory from the government, or like the officials, so that I think it's like your first time, you don't know how cold you'll get, kind of thing. But I was like dripping sweat inside because it was very hot, and I was like, oh, this is too hot. But yeah, I think I over prepared that day, but there was a time that I had to wear that much and I was okay with it. But as soon as I also got to McMurdo Station, that's the US research facility, it was very unexpectedly big. There was a lot of they had everything. There was like the dorms. I expected to share dorms with a lot of people, but it was just the two of us, which is also my teammate. The food was very good. They had a buffet, like a dorm style kind of food, I would say. They had the best thing about the food part was they had an egg line. I would say,
what's that?
You stand in line and then there's a person that's making real like real eggs for you. Yeah, but in the buffet, actual in the buffet, there was only like the powdered egg kind of stuff. But in the egg line, they would make the real egg. But the egg line was the best part of my mornings because the person that making the egg, she would really wake me up. She's kind of very strong, I would say. She's very, she would like point at you and she'd be like, you, what do you want? Kind of like, because there's so many rice. But every time she's like, you, I'm like, what? And then I would always order like a sunny side up and those kind of things. For lunch and dinner, there was a lot of, I ate a lot of pizza because they had like a full, always rotating a pizza person that's making a pizza. But that's just in the station. In the station, there was also like, what would I call it? Like sauna, which is very unexpected to be down there. A lot of, like every dorm kind of had a sauna and all things. But after a month, we went to a more remote area, which is called a Waste Divide field camp. Those camps, we stayed in a tent, but they also had the like facilities to charge you mobiles. They had like plumbing and everything. They had showers and everything. And they also have a heating system, which is called a Kuma stove, which is very similar to Bukhari, I would say. But instead of wood, they would fill it, light it up with the oil fire, I guess. Yeah. But after, we were supposed to be only there for like, 1 week at max, but we ended up there for 2 weeks in that field camp. There was a lot of storms when we were there. I most of the time got stuck in my tent because my door was covered with snow.
But
yeah, after much delay, we went to our own study areas. The study area, which is called the Thwaites Glacier, it's one of the biggest glaciers in Antarctica. So that was supposed to be our study area. We were supposed to be there for 2 months, which was planned, but only got there for like maybe like 20 to 30 days. At max.
So why were you studying the glacier?
First, when I started my master's, I was trying to study Bhutan's glacier, but all the seismic instruments in Bhutan, they were, at that time, it was on contract with the Kyoto University from Japan. And there was a lot of logistics involved with how I would be able to get my data to study it, so I really didn't want to wait around. So I chose to study Antarctica because it's something different. It's something about glaciers. It's gonna affect every one of us if it does start to break. So that was why I started to choose Antarctica as my study area for my master's. But in Thwaites Glacier, it's really not my study area. Thwaites Glacier is mainly like the overall project's study area. So the project is under something called like the International Thwaites Glacier Collaboration, which is like a collaboration between the United States and the United Kingdom's like environmental research kind of collaboration. So our project team project is called TIME. It's called Thwaites Interdisciplinary Margin Evolution. So it's like it has a lot of people from United Kingdom and US, but that's the project's study area. So it's I guess they Thwaites is the largest glacier in West Antarctica. It is approximately the size of the state of Florida in the United States, if that makes sense for many people. But it is one of the fastest flowing glacier as well in West Antarctica. So if it was to melt down, it would hold a lot of it would probably be equal to around 11 feet of sea level change if it was to melt. So that is such a big impact that it has on the sea level as well. But my study area is around the U.S. Research area, research station, which is called the McMurdo Ice Shelf. It's quite important for United States in aspect of like operational as well as like environmental aspect, because that's where most of the flights land. So those big U.S. Air Force plane that I was talking about, those planes are, that's where they land most of the first and then go to other places. But that airfield that's in McMurdo Ice Shelf that has been relocated thrice since its original construction, and that's a big concern for the United States like Antarctic program and most of the Antarctic programs in the country in the world, I guess, because shifting an airfield, making another airfield is kind of a big logistical problem. So yeah.
I can imagine. Let's go back a little bit, though. Did you always want to be like a geophysicist? Was studying climate change important to you? How did this all happen?
Climate change, like the studying the Earth, has been important for me for a long time, I would say. I guess it was already ingrained in many Bhutanese about the importance of environmental science. Like there was always the aspect of preserving your environment and stuff like that. But when I first started in UTEP, I wanted to be a hydrologist because I was planning to work as a like a hydropower person back in Bhutan if I ever did go back to Bhutan. That was my plan, but I was not very good at hydrology. In my undergrad research, I struggled a lot with hydrology. Like, it was just too much for me. Most of the concepts I couldn't really understand, or like it was just harder for me to put it in practical use for me. And also so the best way to study the Earth would be through chemistry or physics or biology. And I did not like biology at all ever since I was a young girl. I just couldn't grasp the concepts of biology. There were just too many stuff going on in biology. And chemistry, I realized I was not good at it too. So that left me with the choice of physics. So in my undergrad research advisor, he was like, maybe you should talk with Dr. Marianne Karplus. She's one of the biggest geophysicists on the campus, and I guess in the west side as well. She's very good with active seismic, active geophysics stuff. So he told me to talk with her, and I kind of talked with her, and then I realized I was better in physics than chemistry and biology. So here I am. So yeah, it was not really, oh, I want to be this, but I guess life goals change in the world.
But look where it took you. I think you chose the right thing. And and you're here sharing the experience with us. Like, many of us will never ever be able to go to the South Pole, even if you want to, you know, and then we want to do it vicariously through you. So thank you for giving us a chance to do that. So one of the challenges you highlighted already about how sometimes you couldn't leave your tent because there was so much snow outside. Like, what the other, because I hear like some of the good experience, but what were some of the challenges you encountered there?
I think everyday challenge for me was getting dressed. Sometimes I would get dressed too much, and sometimes I would not dress enough. So like, even if you're hot and sweating in Antarctica, it's not good, because that sweat can turn into ice and probably give you a frostbite. But like, everyday challenges, like finding the right balance between what to wear and whatnot. So I wore a lot of layers. So I would wear like a base layer first, which is like a thermal. And then on top of that, I would wear like something windproof. And on top of that, I would wear like a fleece, and on top of that, the big jacket, and sometimes two fleeces underneath and stuff like that. And then I would have to cover my entire face. Sometimes I don't have to cover all my face because sometimes if it's not windy, then I don't really need protection in my cheeks and stuff like that. But it was just like everyday challenges were just simple clothing issues and what to wear, what not to wear kind of things. Because, yeah,
Are the
overdressed.
temperatures extreme? So the temperatures are extreme. I was assuming that a lot of us assume that because it's in the South Pole, always covered with ice, it must be frigid. But so there's like really extreme temperatures.
It's not really, the temperatures were almost around negative 30 degrees Celsius kind of stuff, but it was just mainly with the wind. Sometimes it was very windy, and sometimes it was just not. With the wind, it's a big factor because you couldn't see. Sometimes you can't even see to the next tent, which is only like 30 meters right next to me. But sometimes it's so windy that there's snow blowing everywhere. You cannot see the next tent, kind of stuff. So it's the problem with mostly the wind.
And you only had like internet and mobile connectivity when you were at the McMurdo station. When you went beyond that, you weren't connected to the world, per se.
We in the waste divide, they had internet. There was some, I think one of our teammates, he also had like a satellite dish for internet. So if when the weather was nice outside, when it's sunny, he would put out the satellite out, and then we would have the internet. But yeah, it was not really reliable because it depended on weather. So we really, it was like we had no connectivity, but we had that connection in case we needed help. Because you can imagine being so distant and remote, sometimes we might need help. So it was just in case of that. Yeah.
So were you ever afraid, like while you were there, was there an instance that you're like, oh man, maybe I should not have come here?
It was no, I don't think so. I never had that feeling. I was just very prepared for any kind of problems, I would say. Like whenever I went out in the field, like whenever we drove in snowmobiles, we would pack a lot of extra clothes, extra food, extra stuff like that. But there was one day that I think that's my biggest like the toughest part of my season, I would say. I forgot to take my GPS. That was a big problem with us, or with me, I guess. That was my biggest fear, and it just happened that I forgot to take it. There was a lot of stuff that I was carrying. I was carrying a lot of instruments to deploy in the field, like the seismic instruments. I was deploying them in the field, but then I was with another person, and her GPS was being finicky, so she got very frustrated, and she was like, "I'm very frustrated with this instrument. Yishe, can you take it out?" And then mine, I just forgot it back in my tent, and I was like, "Oh, I just forgot it." And the weather wasn't really great at that time. There was no wind, but it was like a ping pong ball effect. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. It's like wherever you look, it's just white, so it just looked like you're trapped in a ping pong ball. So in other days, when there was the suns are out, then the sun is out, I guess, you could see the other people driving by you as well, like our teammates driving by. But that day we couldn't see anything. We couldn't see past 100 meters away, and then I just forgot to take my GPS, and I was very, very scared. But her GPS works every time, but you had to restart every time you put a new point. So if we were to go from 50 meters far, you just have to restart her GPS and do it. And then it was just very scary for me. I was very scared and guilty for leaving my
I can imagine.
GPS.
I can imagine. Like you see, no, there's like literally no landmarks, right? You can't identify. Yeah, that must have been frightening. I would have been frightened too. My God. But what about like a memorable experience besides your egg line? Like, what was a memorable experience for you?
In the field, I would say we would always at the end of the day, so we ran on a 24-hour shift, the entire team, because, well, the sun never sets, so you have the opportunity to work 24 hours. So like three of our teammates would work at night, so at like their work day would start at 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. and our work day was like around 4 a.m. to 4 p.m. So it was just a fun. So our dinner was their breakfast. So the best memories would be like trying to find what to cook. Because if it was just night or like if it was just one shift, we could cook something spicy and not fear having disturbed their bellies or something like that. So just memories, the best memories would be just like cooking together, eating food together. Most of the food were canned foods, I would say. So like canned beans and canned vegetables. We also had like a freezer or like a cooler full of frozen meat and stuff like that. So trying to find what to eat and always making fun of the cook, whoever cooks it sometimes was not a great cook. It was just those kind of things, like trying to cook. Yeah, I think that was the biggest memories I have. And also during storm days, we would read together a lot. I had a friend, he's from Madison, Wisconsin. We would read similar books, and during storm days, we would talk about the book, sometimes get frustrated with the book. I would get very frustrated with most of the books I was reading because I chose very dark books, I would say. Like it was very, like 1974 is a book, I think. It's quite sad. It's about like being alone, those kind of thing book. I was just not happy with the choice of book that I chose, but I had no other option because Kindle needs internet to be loading into the book. And I was like, I should not have chosen a book that's very, very sad. Those kind of things.
But what about the animals? Because I remember the first days that you were there, you were sending me these videos of, were they seals? They were seals, right?
Yes, they were seals.
So did you see a lot of them?
Yes, the Weddell seals, they would come up on McMurdo ice shelf kind of thing, or even in like surrounding our research station, because I think the sea ice, it's already frozen, so they're easily able to come up for sun. And that's also another, I think I talked with one of the researcher about the Weddell seal population, and they said that's the most kind of like a protected area from predators yet, because like the predators really they can't come and attack them. They usually come where there's like melted ice, I would say. So at the end, so they would come up, and that the mothers would give birth and have their pups and stuff like that. So we were able to kind of see all of them.
But what is the only animals that you saw while you were there?
No. So in the beginning of the season, so that's when the sea ice was frozen, everything was still cold. That was the only sea animal I was able to see, like, because it's frozen, so the orcas didn't come. But at the end, like around February, that's when sea ice melts, and that's where also like a lot of coastal ships come for like sometimes for touristy stuff and sometimes for logistical, like the government has sent them kind of thing. So that when the ships were coming or like docking, the other animals were out as well. So like the penguins were out, Weddell seals were always out, but like the orcas were also out, and minke whales, they were also out. Yeah.
Wow. What was that like, the first time you saw the whales?
Yes, I think I was the first one to spot the minke whales, because we were in a room in the second floor, so we could see the sea ice. I saw a triangle move, and I was like, there's something moving in the water, and everyone looked, and it was a minke whale. It was very cool.
Oh, nice.
To see. Yeah.
What's your message to everybody who's watching you and listening to you on the podcast?
It's quite hard for me to say a message. There's everyone's having their difficult time, they have their own story. It's not like I could say, oh, be this or that, but I would just say to find something you love or something you like. Education is quite important to everyone, but finding something that they like is the most important, I would say. Like education doesn't always mean college and stuff. There's a lot of other forms of education you can pursue, and if it's something that you like, then it should be that. You can probably make a living out of something you really like. It's better than doing something you don't like.
And I love that you adapted and you changed. You're like, okay, this is not something I like, so I would like to pursue this. Or trying to figure out what works for you by first negating what doesn't work for you. And I love that life path, you know? So thanks so much for sharing all of that. Thanks for sharing about Antarctica. I loved hearing that, for inviting us into a personal and a professional life experience of yours that all of us celebrated as well as envied. But yeah, like we celebrate you and your travel, your studies. I wish you all the best, Tishe, and I look forward to many more adventures at your end.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who's watching us and listening to us. This is Hello from Bhutan. Thank you.